The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to the Friday Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Thanks for joining us today. As always, it is great to be here. A couple of quick announcements, and then, as always, right into our program. For those of you who would like to call the program today, the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. For those of you outside the United States, this is an MCI toll-free number. I understand that you can call your local MCI operator in the country where you are, and that MCI operator can connect you into this toll-free number. Again, it is 1-866-687-7223. For those of you who are using email, the three addresses are dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for those of you who prefer chat, the screen name is all one word, Space Show Chat, and that works with IM, ICQ, and CompuServe. Remember, if you are using the toll-free line, let it ring until it's answered. There are no call screeners here. Please be patient until we can bring you up on the air. And everybody, remember, the Space Show is an educational program only. We don't endorse people's business plans or projects or ventures. Despite any excitement you may hear in my voice or with anyone else on the program is a registered trademark and service mark for me. I have the copyright. So please download the shows, put them on CD or DVD, share them with your friends, help get the word out. Don't do anything commercial, and please don't modify or play with the text of any of the interview. We have special thanks to Andrew for their terrific free podcasting service at gigadial.net. I recommend their service very, very strongly. Our RSS subscription URL is on our website and both newsletters. We are iTunes compliant. We're listed at Podcast Alley. If you have any problems subscribing to our RSS feed, please send me a note to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also, our Deep Space Message Contest is open. Read about it on our website. We're coming up on a decision time for the next message. If you're interested, after you read about it on our website, send your entry or any questions that you may have to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everybody, check out our website. It is thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded every Monday, and it tells you what's happening on into the future. I think we even have some guests planned going into the end of the year already. If we need to change a show or make a special announcement, you'll see it on that website newsletter, so check it from time to time. And then if you want the short email version emailed to you also on Monday that simply tells you what's happening in any given week on the program, please send your subscription request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, and all of our programs from 6-plus years ago are on our website. They're podcasts, they're MP3 format, and they're available to you anytime you want them free of charge. Check out also the Space Show store we have on our website, and you'll also see a Support the Space Show button. Remember that we are part of a nonprofit, 501c3, One Giant Leap Foundation. We appreciate those of you who have supported us and those of you who will support us. It's a really big undertaking to do a radio show for space, just like it is to do things in space in general. And your support is very important to us and needed. A couple of quick hold the dates, and then let's get right into our program. The big one coming up, starting this coming week, if you're in the New Jersey area, the Rutgers Symposium on Lunar Settlements, June 3rd through the 8th, and that's in New Brunswick on the Rutgers campus. You can still register. There's still time. Check it out at www.lunarbase.rutgers.edu. And then the Space Frontier Foundation New Space 2007 Conference. This is July 18th through the 21st in the Washington, D.C. area. It starts on July 18th with an overview effect conference with Frank White and others. You can still register and get more information, www.space-frontier.org. And then I'll give you the SmallSat Conference, Logan, Utah, August 13th through the 16th. And I'll be there. Check it out at www.smallsat.org. Well, we're very fortunate today to be doing our first show with a guest live in Switzerland. We have with us today Dr. Bruno Stanek, and he has studied math at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. He has his PhD in math. He was an instructor in applied mathematics, celestial mechanics, and more between 66 and 72. And he was a scientific programmer for the chemical industry at Basel and also for Swissair. He was mostly a freelance mathematician. He was involved in software and being an author for books and later his own publisher. But he also documented the early days of the space program in Switzerland, and he also has an encyclopedia of space. I believe it's called Space Encyclopedia and Planet Encyclopedia. And he has a software company, Astroware Dr. B.L. Stanek. And he's been doing space TV and radio about space in Switzerland since Apollo 7. That was 1968. And he has been a voice of space in Switzerland for decades. I will post his full bio when I archive the show. Let's start talking with Dr. Stanek rather than reading about him. Welcome to the Space Show from Switzerland. How are you today?
Good morning, David. I'm fine here, except the fact that on June 1st, all-day rain at a slightly more than 50 degrees, so I'm sure you have a better weather in California.
Well, in San Francisco, it's foggy and overcast, which is our typical weather, and it's 54 degrees Fahrenheit right now.
So that's quite comparable.
without the water coming down. How did you get interested in space, and you know, what was the early days of the space program like for you and for others in Switzerland?
Well, for me, it started slightly before 1957. I remember a day my father was a musician, and I once was taken out for a concert on a beautiful summer night, and there was a star in the sky, and nobody could explain me what it was. Today I know, and I could pinpoint it in the ephemerides, and I know it was Jupiter, but nobody knew it was Jupiter, and that's the way it went on. At school, nobody could explain anything decently, and then suddenly, all the journalists were overwhelmed by the fact that Sputnik was launched, and soon the Explorer, and so on, and I noticed that if I want to get into this field, I have to learn it by myself.
And your path.
That's the main reason why I studied mathematics, because I thought that's the tool to really get into it.
So, which I think is interesting, because most people that I talk to that want to get into space, they choose the path of something like astronomy, or they choose engineering. But you chose mathematics.
I chose it for the simple reason because there was no regular course in astronomy. And fortunately, the professor we had contracts with NASA at the time in the 1960s, and boundary value problems and regularization of coordinates and things like that. And this was my only possibility to get into the field, closer to it, at the time and at the university.
And then in the early days of our space program, you had a program on Swiss National TV for the space program. Is that correct?
That is correct. And already as a student, I knew by 1962 that President Kennedy had announced the moon program. I was following it. There were professors at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology who at the time heard that they had an opportunity later on to analyze moon rocks. Now, when they went to their academic superiors and asked for funds for that, they were laughed at. They were telling me that. In the early 1960s, everybody laughed at them. And so was it for me. I had a lecture where I was the only listener. Everybody said, why do you go there? There was a very old professor. It was orbit determination in the solar system. So you see, if you are the only listener, the only student of a professor, this means that people had no idea. If you talk to people, they said, well, the Russians will be first anyway, which was, of course, wrong. I knew, but nobody wanted to believe it until they learned it the hard way by history.
During the Apollo era, was there quite a bit of interest in Switzerland to our going to the moon? Were people fixated on TV when we were actually on the moon? What was it like in Switzerland for that?
For me, it was very rewarding when step by step this moon program unfolded actually exactly the way it was planned. And so I could somehow raise the interest of the Swiss population. It was made simpler for me due to the fact that we had a state monopoly on television. All the competition we had came from Austrian television or from German television, and this was terrestrial television. Not everybody had it in a hilly country. So we had a lot of listeners and an audience which cannot be reached anymore today, despite the fact that the population has risen. So it was very rewarding for me to see everything that I announced in the Apollo 7, 8, and so on series, that it was actually done later on, and that Apollo 11 went, like Armstrong said, it was like in the simulator. And that's what it was like for me. So everything I planned, animations or graphics and so on, which allowed me to explain it to the layman in a way that he got interested and he knew that he could understand what was said on television, something he might have stopped doing earlier. So step by step, I was learning. And the audience was learning, and this was the best time, of course. I was at an age of 25 when I started with Apollo 7 and 8. And, well, maybe next time they launch to the moon, I will be 75. So it's a good time I had to follow the space program.
Now, you got to interview and talk with von Braun and quite a few of the early astronauts, correct?
Right. That was also a coincidence. We have a museum in Switzerland, which is called the Transport Museum, and its founder was a space-interested person, too. He was older than I am. He is born in 1919. He's still around, and he invited those guests. He had John Glenn. He had von Braun. He had the Apollo 13 crew. And I always had an opportunity to share the excitement with them. I had them in the television shows, either in the Federal Administration Building in Bern, that's our capital, or in the studio in Zurich. And this was interesting that as a student, you maybe were just a listener to, in 1966 it was, that John Glenn came to the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and just a couple of years later, I was the moderator of the show myself, so it all went very fast. But at the time, nobody was better informed. I was lucky to have the opportunity in 1965, during a student trip, already to visit the Kennedy Space Center, which was not yet, I think it wasn't called Kennedy Space. It just was about the time when it was called Kennedy Space Center. So nobody had an idea what it all looked like there. And this makes you feel very secure of what you are talking about when you have been there, have been reading thousands of pages of NASA documents and also by professors who were at MIT at the time when the software was developed for Apollo. So we had a professor in Zurich who was for one semester there. He had the impression I was the only one who was really interested in what he was talking about. I learned a lot. He gave me all his papers before he left. And later on, I found out that he was the one who was relatively close to Buzz Aldrin when he was at MIT developing the software, the rendezvous software and so on, the simplified equations, which could be handled by those computers at the time. And all those differential equations later on, he was writing on by himself. That's now that's a career for somebody in mathematics, which I didn't have the opportunity to follow.
What city in Switzerland is this museum in?
What city in Switzerland? I may have misunderstood. The studio was in Zurich.
No, but the transportation museum that you talked about.
Oh, in Luzern.
Excuse me,
I didn't mention that. It's Luzern. Everybody who comes from America, he knows he has to see Luzern, and I didn't mention it. It's a shame. Yeah, it's Luzern.
You know, if you fast forward today to 2007, and do you see a big difference in the way the space program, I guess just to be crude, is being marketed and therefore of interest to young people in college age, university age, or the general public? Are we doing something dramatically different, or is it just a question of times having changed and competing interest with other issues that go on in the world? How do you assess the difference between the Apollo era and what we have going on today as we're trying to get back to the moon?
Well, it's different threats which mix in with each other. If you take the media have totally changed. We had only one channel at the time, and it had to be responsible for every opinion, of course, and so it was balanced, and I was just the right person at the right time. So that is totally different now. We have all kinds of channels, like in America, some very good ones, high-quality channels, low-quality channels, but something going through all of them is a very anti-American attitude. I don't understand it. My wife doesn't understand it. We travel a lot through America. I have a lot of friends who know America. But the media, they are telling that the moon landing has been a fake and so on. And maybe even more people today start believing that nonsense. On the other hand, there are teachers who do their best to educate their children or to organize a speech when I give a lecture on the future, on the past, or whatever. And I noticed that there are a lot of young kids who cannot be fooled. They know that space is around. They know that something is going on, like I knew it in the 50s. But many, many people still believe what's being said in the mass media, and space has a very low image on the media. I remember a time when every nonsense that was published by the TASS agency was repeated and was in the news and everybody believed it. And today, it suddenly changed. As soon as everybody had to feel that the United States was leading in space, the same things which were said to be important for humanity were unimportant from one day to the next. And one of those turning points was in 1969 and till 72, but it went on even more. As soon as the Russians couldn't be highlighted anymore for their enormous progress in space stations, which never, neither in America nor in Russia, lived to its full potential, then nothing was interesting anymore. And all those problems with the space shuttle, which are very unfortunate because it's a very advanced transportation medium, but it's too expensive, and it's delicate, it's old, and it has never been allowed to be upgraded. So all the small problems which lead to delays and so on, they are reported about in the media, but when they do something great or a problem is solved, that's not news. Now you can imagine if you do that for a decade or two or three, then the interest of the superficial people starts to decline. That's what I have to say overall into what has changed. But the smart young kids, they are still interested in everything, and it's a pleasure to lecture to them.
This is a note that I've received from Rita, and she is in Chicago. And she says, did I understand you correctly when you said that the mainstream press in Switzerland says that we did not go to the moon and the moon landings were fake? About 25% of Americans say we never went to the moon, but generally our press does not promote that, although from time to time there are special shows that come up on some of the alternative television stations that do a feature about that. What percentage do you think of Swiss people believe we never went to the moon? And is Switzerland different from the rest of Europe in this sense?
A very interesting point. I have seen some of those broadcasts in America, and what I liked there was that it was said, well, listen to it. Of course, everybody in NASA and scientists say that it has been real, but, well, enjoy yourself, watch it. We had it, the same broadcast in Switzerland on the second channel, which should be responsible for a decent information of the public. They broadcast it without that warning. Now, can you imagine if I go to a train station and people come to me, shout at me, and say, Dr. Stanek, admit it now, immediately. It's all nonsense. I have seen it on television last night. And these are people who may have even a higher income than I have. So it's really special here. That makes the difference. Maybe we have 25% too who believe that nonsense. But if I'm cynical, I say the problem is not that it's 25%, but that these 25%, excuse me, sit in the media. That's the problem. So I don't know how many really believe it. And as soon as you give them arguments or you show it to someone, I have it. I have a small sketch on my homepage in the form of a video. As soon as someone has seen that, he doesn't want to be ridiculed and he doesn't believe it anymore. But who takes the effort to really try to get the facts and build his opinion?
What about other parts of Europe? Is it similar to what you're seeing in Switzerland?
I would say it's similar. We don't travel that much in Europe, but what I know relatively well, that's Germany, of course, is same language, same similar population. It's maybe a little bit better, but not much.
You know, it's almost hard to imagine that type of information passes for serious or legitimate news or documentary, you know, material. What would be the motivation for the sources putting that information out there to distort people's minds and reality?
One problem is that many journalists did not grow out of hard science, but of soft science. And they always have, that's what I noticed over a lifetime, that they have a hidden technophobia inside, because they know that these were the subjects at high school, college, and so on, which almost dropped them out of school. And they keep that technophobia for a long time, or forever. And if they see an opportunity to halt progress in that field, and they try to do it. It may be a little bit cynical what I say here, but I mean it. I've observed it long enough, inside and outside television stations.
Bob in Boston says, if a person wants to study space-related fields today in Switzerland, are there academic programs in the universities that now address space sciences, space engineer, astronomy, physics, so that a person could do that within the Swiss university system?
It's a little bit better now, but there are still a lot of young people who know my address, ask me for what they should do, and who know that it's limited what they can study new fields. We have our Swiss astronaut, Claude Nicollier. He now lectures in French at the University of Geneva and at the Polytechnic in Lausanne, which is like a brother or sister relationship to the Polytechnic in Zurich. He has changed it. In Stuttgart, Germany, the astronaut Messerschmidt, Ernst Messerschmidt, I recently met him, and he has a chair in Stuttgart. Hario Ruppe had one for a long time in Berlin, I think, and it's getting better, but it's still very limited, totally incomparable to what you have in the United States, which is a spacefaring nation.
Very interesting. Do you think that if we are able to get back to the moon, and you know, there's a lot of people, even in the space community in the United States, who are not so sure this program is going to become successful. But do you think if we do get back to the moon, this will change things? Will it be credible? Will it be believable among the press and among people in Switzerland? Or will there still be a credibility issue?
No, I think it will end immediately. The last time when this was going on in the Apollo days, nobody questioned the reality of what was going on. And I remember things that you could say, yeah, once somebody tried, I think it was in a major boulevard newspaper, said, only the Russians could help. That was the headline. And so on television in the evening, I said, well, if they could help, they would have gone themselves. So if someone is around who can nullify those non-valid arguments, immediately people stop believing that. And they see what's going on, and they start believing that, as it was last time, when I said that I give you an example. I met Sebastianov probably on the first occasion when he met the Western astronaut in the Swiss Transport Museum. Mr. Valdis, he was able to invite them both. He was very proud of it in 1971, and he hired me for moderating this because I spoke German, French, and and English. And he was asked by a journalist, isn't it better what you do in Russia? You have unmanned moon probes, and you build space stations. Don't you think it's dangerous what America does, sending humans to the moon? And in his Russian accent, in the German, he said, Was glauben Sie, warum wir Kosmonauten geworden sind? What do you think? Why do you think we became cosmonauts? We wanted to go to the moon. He, of course, Sebastianov in 1971, he knew they had a program, a moon program. It was not yet stopped in 71. So he wanted to go. And the journalist asked him that it's a stupid idea to go up there in the first place. So when everybody knew at the time, if the program hadn't been real, people like Sebastianov and others would have had access to TASS agency, and everybody in the media would have known it hasn't taken place, it's all a hoax. But nobody could do it because everybody at the time knew it was real. And so will it be the next time? We shall have the lunar reconnaissance orbiter next year. And of course, it can't see all the landing places, all the spacecraft, the three lunar rovers up there, all the tracks on the moon. You can't fake that. And everybody sees that. And I have met a lot of cosmonauts. They all laugh when they hear that we have the story going around. It's not real. So next time, I'm sure, people will be excited again like the last time.
Everybody hold right where you are. We're going to take our first break. Our guest today, Dr. Bruno Stanek, with us from Switzerland. Stay where you are, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is your host of The Space Show, David Livingston. Our guest today is Dr. Bruno Stanek. He is with us from Switzerland. And Bruno, I have this question that has come in at the end of the first segment. This is from Carl in Silver Springs, Maryland. And he says, I am intrigued with how you're describing the thoughts of our space program with people in Switzerland, the news service, and the anti-Americanism. It seems to me that a lot of anti-American feelings come from the Bush administration and our war in Iraq and our war on global terror. Can you date the space anti-Americanism and the distrust of our having gone to the moon to the Bush administration and the Iraqi war and terror war? Or does this feeling and this activity in Switzerland predate all of these more recent events?
It certainly predates all that. It started with Columbus, and it went on like that because always the best were emigrating, the most people with most initiative, and they were envied and so on. So that started early. I have seen it with Ronald Reagan, who was a very good president, in my opinion, as a foreigner. He was a great man. And it was as bad at the time of Reagan. He was described as a cowboy or an actor and whatever. We had actors in our government. Nobody ever questions their ability to do anything in politics, but for Reagan, it was not allowed, despite the fact that he was really a great man. And it was with every president. The only one who had a good press in Switzerland was Jimmy Carter, which I thought was doing not too many good things for America. So this is not true. It's not with Bush. It's just for people with a short memory who have forgotten that it was going on for decades like that.
Okay, and Peter in Austin, Texas, sent in a note and says, I recall during the Apollo 8 flight when they had the first TV picture of the full Earth, and Walter Cronkite said, quote, there you have it, proof, Earth is round, end quote. But he also said the Flat Earth Society claimed we were being hoodwinked by NASA and it was all fake. So there will always be a few kooks who will say hoax. Peter in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, he's certainly right, but I always think of an American saying, maybe you'll correct me, it's not from America, maybe other folks around the globe have said the same intelligent things. You can fool a few people all the time, and you can fool all the people for some time, but not all the people all the time. And I think this has saved humanity from extinction.
And hopefully it will keep working. Tell us more about the Lovell and the Sebastiani meeting.
I remember that I just told you that Sebastiano was very annoyed when he was confronted by the Swiss journalist with the question whether or not it was totally unnecessary to reduce human lives on the moon. And I knew why I knew at the time why he reacted so annoyed, because I had seen him just a couple of hours earlier watching a 16-millimeter movie that had been brought to the museum by another astronaut, and it was one of those Apollo 15, brand new movies taken from the automobile, from the lunar rover, and the astronaut was sitting, one was driving, the other one was sitting with the 16-millimeter camera and took the picture of the rolling landscape all around. And I had seen the movie before, that's why I watched Sebastiano's face. And you can't imagine how fast, that was fascination at its purest, how Sebastiano, who was in the KGB and the cosmonaut, so he was allowed to do more and to see more and to know more, and he really wanted to go there too, and it was a great experience for him to meet Jim Lovell, who had been with Apollo 8 around the moon, and their discussion was interesting to witness. Sebastianov spoke German and Russian. Lovell only spoke English, and there was a Russian interpreter who spoke Russian and French. That's why I was needed inside to translate, and so I could follow all those discussions at a time when we really were in the middle of the Cold War in a neutral country like Switzerland and in Lucerne. And that's what I always remember at a time when sense or nonsense of moon flights is discussed, or hoax or no hoax. Then I wish everybody had seen the reality in reality at that time.
Betsy in San Diego says, have you been fortunate enough to meet any of the current or more recent astronauts or current executives working with the NASA and the public space program, or even the private space program in America? If you have, how do you contrast these people to the pioneers that you've been talking about on the show so far?
I spend about a couple of weeks every year in the U.S., which is a great opportunity to see the future. Sometimes I meet people. I'm not an important person in the space business. I'm a long-time observer and have observed the interest and so on. But I had an opportunity to meet a lot of people by chance, Leonov and so on. And in America, the more recent people, they are just too many. These are private entrepreneurs who try to make space tourism a reality. I have not met one of those. They would be very interesting to talk to and to see a difference. I have met older engineers who worked on the big rockets for a long time. I had an opportunity to meet Dannenberg, who was the propulsion engineer on the V2 and then on the Saturn V also, Stuhlinger and so on. These are the old folks. And when I talk to them about the point you raised to me now, I have the impression that they think that all those newer efforts are not so focused anymore, despite the fact that fewer people are working in these fields. You remember the number between 300,000 and 500,000 engineers and technicians,
right,
working on the moon program. And today it's a much smaller number. And one would think that a smaller number can be more focused. But if very often I'm asked, why is the progress so slow? I want to emphasize that Apollo was realized between about 61 and 69, 6.5 years net. The earliest that we can do it again is 13 years. That's twice as much. So they had 16 kilobytes in their computers. Today, you could easily have a gigabyte in the computer and automate everything. So why does it take so long? And I'm often asked that, why is it taking so long when you can realize every drawing in a second and you have it on paper or on the screen or wherever you want to have it? Or even an animation of a spacecraft flying, which isn't even built. You have everything today, so why does it take twice as long? And one of the reasons I give, to oversimplify, but to make the point, is at the time of Apollo, you had four engineers and one lawyer. Today you have four lawyers and one engineer. And that explains the difference. A lot has changed. You have extremely smart people with strong tools in their hands, but the process, the political process of realizing something, the media influence to fascinate new young people, that has changed. The engineers very often are from another generation. They are no longer a constant stream of young engineers. Almost all those I met in the States were the ones who were very young engineers at the time NASA was founded in 58. We were there from the beginning, and today are retiring or cannot retire because they are still needed and have important knowledge.
I have had Conrad Danberg and Sonny Mariah, Paul Kaufman, Al Zeringer, and I'm probably forgetting some names of the graybeards on this show over the past 2 years up until just even last month, as we like to refer to them as graybeards. And you're right, they definitely believe the focus is not there. But one of the things that they're always quick to point out is that the Apollo program, including Gemini and Mercury, that whole period had the full priority of the United States government behind it because of the absolute priority of outdoing the Soviet Union at every way. And we don't have any priority of the full U.S. government behind us. Also, they point out that the young engineers also don't know the history, and they don't go back into the documents and the records, so they repeat a lot of the errors that these guys made and that are well documented in the literature. But these people don't go back and research the literature. They just sort of plow forward and they move ahead. And then, of course, Congress is not making going back to the moon a priority. So the truth is the program is not funded to do it on any kind of an expedient, you know, basis. They feel there's no hurry for it. There's no priority. And then the risk averseness of the way our government and NASA have become so that we can't afford to lose a life, we can't take a risk. They didn't have that risk aversion during the days of Apollo and Gemini and Mercury. And so they were able to move forward in a faster, in a different climate than what we have today. And, you know, I think we'll be lucky if we get back to the moon by 2020. I'm not even sure we'll make that, you know, that timetable. So, I think NASA would need to be funded at $30 billion a year, not $16 billion, to get us back to the moon on any kind of a reasonable timetable. And this is a real drawback for inspiring and motivating young people, even in this country, that long time period.
Well, it's all right what you said. Every single point is right. And we all think for a long time, how could we change that? And there is not a simple solution. It starts, of course, with education, educating the politicians. But imagine the time when, a minute or two, when John F. Kennedy and Wernher von Braun, the two, aristocrats riding in an open car through the streets. I think it was in Huntsville, Alabama, and they trusted each other. I'm sure John F. Kennedy wanted to start a program. He could be convinced that it could be done, and von Braun knew it could be done. And he did it, at least. He did the moon rocket, but he had devised plans for landing on the moon and so on. He could prove it with his publications that he had the ideas. And it was all realized in the short time span of a couple of years at the time. And it could again be done, so it must be something which prevents us from doing it. And
well,
that's a problem which cannot be solved. It's the same here. Look at Europe. We have now 460 million people working together, more or less. And, of course, the budget is smaller, but the number of people also determines how much you can do, how large bases you have of engineers and so on. And we lag very far behind, in my opinion, to American space industry. And you have everything now you need. In over all those years, many, not only me, but a lot of people ask, how would we go to the moon? Could we do it again? Everything was ready. the computers, the software, the solids, the external tanks, everything is ready. In the Swiss Transport Museum, you would find a cargo rocket built of an external tank, which I used for my regular television series in 1975-76 on Swiss television. And it's still there. I photographed it recently. And it was in 76, before the first shuttle flew, one knew with these building blocks, you can build an enormous rocket which puts up 100 tons. And over all those years, we knew if you use what you have, and that's what your NASA administrator tries to do now, with the regular budget, using what you have to build a new infrastructure to go to the moon. So if I look at your program, at NASA's program currently, it's extremely smart. They had so many more detailed ideas than I had thinking over it for years now. So I was always very impressed by the smartness of that idea and that program. But, so I would believe it could be done until 2020. But on the other hand, you have all those illiterates where you can repeat again and again what's a fact, and you could try to educate them, and they will again tell the same old nonsense, what they have heard on the media, what's not true, some hoax, and so on. So I'm not so sure if it can be done, but humanity shouldn't be proud if it is not being done by 2020. Then it would be proof that our civilization is definitely on the way down. If with all we have now, and with a solid organization and the technical background, if we cannot do it until 2020, we have failed. Others, ask Conrad Dannenberg and all those who did it of that generation with the slide rule, they did it with much simpler means the first time, and they did it right. And so all the young engineers and high school students who listen to this program should be made proud of their country, that others outside of their country believe that Americans certainly would be able to do it again.
We should bring you over to testify before Congress. You tell the story very, very well, and I always say on the space show that the space story is not told properly. If it were told properly, we would be doing this moon program and our space program for the betterment of humanity much, much faster than what we're doing now. We would have a different way of valuing and appreciating space and our efforts in space, but that is unfortunately not the case.
You had very good communicators. You had Von Braun, you had Carl Sagan, you had others, and I would even repeat again a name I have mentioned before, Ronald Reagan. They would be the good communicators who can convince what's really important for humanity and what's not.
You know,
and that's also what I attribute to the success I had with my television programs during the Apollo days. Explain it in a way that every slightly technical person, who auto mechanic and everybody, they came to me on the road and in the on the railroad, came to me, let explain it again, and they were fascinated just because they knew they could share with the excitement, because they thought they knew what was going on. And during book signings, I often wrote something into their books, which in German says, I tried to translate it later on, Unterhaltung ist Lustgewinn durch Verstehen. That means entertainment is the gain in a good feeling just by understanding. That's the translation of
Go ahead.
Unterhaltung ist Lustgewinn durch Verstehen. And you can make everybody interested in what's going on in science. Von Braun once has said, in sports, soccer or tennis, you have camps for fascinating the children. Why don't we do it for the space camps? Now you have the space camps. That's an enormously good idea. I once had the opportunity to be in one of those together with my son. And this is a very great idea. And that's the path to follow. You do at least something in America, and you could do more. But if you compare it to the enormous number of people in other parts of the world, you are only 5%, I think. So what America already does is surprising. But from inside, when I talk to Americans very often, they don't even see that they may be a limited country, but it's still the one who does the most on the planet. So you are in a good starting position.
You know, I often on the space show talk about the way that the treaty organization, which is located in Paris, the OECD, speaks about space in their documents and papers called Space 2030. And they have two or three of these 300-page documents, and they show how space should be and can be used to better the world today and to make people's living so much better today, not just in rich countries, but around the world. And their material is the best I've ever seen, and yet that story is not picked up in this country by NASA or by anyone. I promise you, if that story, if the OECD documents were mainstream reading somehow, or were even known about in high school science classes, or even social studies classes, or government political science classes, or in college levels, we would have a vastly different space program today and a vastly different informed public today. And it gives me a chance to finally plug that the long-awaited space show OECD program is now scheduled with Professor Henry Hertzfeld, as well as Pierre-Alain Scheib from OECD. And that program is going to be on July 13th. It is already set up. And I'm going to try to bring the OECD work again to more people. But the story of space is vastly different from what we hear, what our media talks about. It's vastly different than the entrepreneurial movement, although that's extremely important, but it's a different kind of space. It's quite different from what Elon Musk and SpaceX are doing to lower the cost of space access through innovative business techniques in rocket building. I would urge people to read the June edition of Wired magazine that does a phenomenal job of documenting what Elon is doing, or listen to Gwen Shotwell this coming Friday on the Space Show. But Bruno, if we told the story differently, if we understood what the OECD was talking about, we would be spacefaring long before 2007, certainly long before 2020.
Exactly, and I think also, if those early pioneers had guessed when it's all going to happen, they would never have thought that it takes 50 years at best to set again to foot on the moon and do something permanent on our nearest celestial body. That was really unexpected for most of us who observed the program over this half century.
I'm getting a lot of questions, and people want to ask you about the space entrepreneurism, the space tourism. How is that received in Switzerland? So, for example, here's a question from George in Dallas, and they say, many people here are lining up to fly on suborbital space tourism with the rocket ships that are being made in Mojave and elsewhere. Do people in Switzerland know that space tourism is about to break through as a commercial industry? And is there interest in going to space among people in the general population?
Surprisingly, yes. They know it. And I can give you an example. When Galileo was on Jupiter, which was a totally different thing, I was interviewed by some journalists about this research on this giant planet. And he said, when can Swiss spend their first vacation on Jupiter? That shows the interest of those people. And he didn't mean it as a joke. He thought, he really thought that one day this has to lead to tourism, and then people start getting interested. Now, these, let's say, the Spaceship One and its Galaxy spacecraft, which go to 60, 70 miles altitude, they have raised the interest here because there are a lot of people who could spend the 200,000 Swiss francs or $150,000 dollars to do the trip, and then it starts getting interesting for all those who were not interested in it before. So I'm sure this is an important endeavor, this space tourism, just to fuel the interest and to raise the eyes to the sky. It's important.
Is there any kind of space commerce or entrepreneurial effort or desire to be in the space business on the private sector format in Switzerland, or is it just not there yet?
Switzerland is a small country. It's about half of Florida. So, and it's consisting of three and a half languages. So it's not a big country. But of course, we have a long history in engineering and in heavy industry, building diesel engines and so on. But it has decayed a lot over the last few decades. I remember it was a Swiss company who built the first lenses for a camera on your 16mm camera on the moon. It's no longer existing. It was leading. It could they could make the optics which withstood shocks, vacuum, temperatures, differences, and everything. And they were leading at the time, still in the 1960s when they were selected. But we don't have many anymore who really can deliver something which, with one big exception, that's the electrical motors for the Mars rovers. They are built in a very remote area in the Swiss Alps. And it's a German engineer who founded this company years back, and they are all very proud that they have the best electrical motors used in medicine and on Mars. So there are exceptions. There are always exceptions. But overall, we have a few individuals who do a great job, who try to fund their experiments and their instruments, which are one day flying on the university level, sometimes in collaboration with some industry. But these are normally only individuals. But if I would compare it to the time when I was interviewing people involved in space industry, in 1969, when we had a lot of, or until about 1980, when I had a lot of broadcasts on national TV, overall, the base has declined. We have more banks, more insurance companies, and so on, white-collar jobs, but the industrial base is not as good as it should be, it could be.
Seems to be the the nemesis of every place, doesn't it? In the West,
yep.
We're all sort of suffering from many of the same issues and the same problems.
Yeah, that's what I notice when I go to America. You usually experience everything a couple of years earlier than we do. You have everything. You had television before we had it, and everything is happening first in America. You know what Einstein once said? Well, he would go during a nuclear war. He would go to Switzerland. Because there, and he surprised everyone with the answer, there everything happens 30 years later. So the Americans are still leading.
Hold it right there, everybody. We'll be back in 2 minutes with The Space Show.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back to the program, everybody. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today from Switzerland, Dr. Bruno Stanek. And Bruno, this is from Bruce, who is right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he says, what is risk-taking like in Switzerland? Are you a risk-averse nation, or are you able to take lots of risk? Is there a regulatory environment against risk-taking? How would you compare that, if you can, with risk-taking in America in 2007?
Well, Switzerland is a country which separates between the mountains and the flatland. And I would say also the population can be separated in some very hard risk takers. Imagine all the mountaineers and so on, and aviation pioneers we had, and others who have more quiet walks of life, and they are risk averse, certainly. Probably every society which has had too good a time for too long a time becomes risk averse. I have noticed what was happening after the war. We had some relatives who spent the wartime across the border and others in Switzerland. And what I noticed as a small boy, that the risk the relatives in Germany, for example, took was much bigger than the one in Switzerland. They had to work. They had to work hard. They had to rebuild a totally destroyed country, while we in Switzerland didn't have to. So their living standard surpassed my relatives in Switzerland relatively fast. So you see, when you have a hard time, you learn to do more at the same time and better. And if it's going too easy, you won't. And even the wars you fight in from America to end injustice in various parts of the world because nobody there is doing it, it helps you somehow. It may sound strangely, but when I see how you can benefit from a hard life, I think even when America is forced to do something the hard way and without the gratitude of other people, somehow it makes you stronger, and I hope so. So there would be many answers to the question of risk averse or not. I'm very grateful that America, for example, helped in Yugoslavia, where really genocide was taking on, and 460 million Europeans only separated by 2 driving hours away, or 5 driving hours away, were watching. And America was doing something. So I don't think America is too risk-averse compared to others.
Well, it sure seems like it is in the NASA environment, for sure.
Here, they have to. They are watched. Because everybody says, why didn't you do it that way? You have a couple of lawyers who tried to make money on finding out that it wasn't done the cheapest way, the best way, and so on. And this paralyzes those risk takers, the ones you still have.
Here is a chat comment and question from Andy, who is in Nottingham in the UK. And he says, are you optimistic about NASA making further great achievements in space, or whether from now on commercial industry will be the pioneers, or indeed whether other countries may lead the way with their space programs?
Good question. I'm not so sure if other countries will surpass the efforts, for example, to go to the moon, the efforts of NASA. Maybe 2-3 generations from now, I don't know. But the next generation and 2020 is within this generation, I don't think anyone will be able to match a space program like the Constellation program, which is planned now with RS-1 and 5 and Orion and the Moon Lander. No one else is ready to do it. So I hope you do it again. Now, you had another question. If I think it is possible, could you repeat the first part of the question?
Hold on a minute. Let me go back to it. Are you optimistic about NASA making additional great achievements in space?
Yes, I have to, I found the way back. Look at the Mars landers. Spirit and Opportunity. This is a program which I will financially compare to something we did in Switzerland. We have a national exhibition which is taking place about once every 20-25 years, and the 2 Mars landers plus everything cost less than this exhibition, which was which has fizzled, in my opinion, and where 1.6 billion francs were wasted and so on, as many agree with me. So it's surprising what those JPL people accomplished, sending up those 2 rovers, which are still running around after 3 years. Now, if a country can do that in 2007, and they are overachievers, every goal that has been set for those Mars rovers has been surpassed. So if you can do it there, you can do it everywhere. if you want to. So, of course, unmanned spaceflight is a little bit cheaper, or substantially cheaper, however, whatever you set the limits. But I'm sure this proves all those successful programs you had on Jupiter, on Pluto Express and so on, which nobody can match, no matter if it's the Chinese or India or ESA, who have substantial programs and a lot of people working behind. If they can't match it, America cannot be so bad with its efforts. And I hope, of course, that this Constellation program will again stand second to nothing, like Apollo did. And you could do it, I'm sure. I've met enough fascinated people in America. You have overachievers in your schools. If I see what's happening in Europe, who first has to learn what you have learned over 300 years, immigration. We now learn immigration. That will be a problem in Western Europe for the next years to chew on it. You have done all that before, so I think you're in a very good position to finish that program, and I hope you do, because as I told you, when I'm 75, I would like to see people stepping on the moon again.
What do you think about the competitive nature and, let's just say, competitive threat with India and China and their space programs? Does it concern you? Does it encourage you? Do you think they can do something greater, faster than what NASA can do?
And a program like that is important for two reasons. Number one, it lets people in those countries better understand space research because they have it very close and they have people they know who work on it. It wouldn't be fortunate to have only one country working on it and others all standing around ignorant. But also from the standpoint of America, if an American politician who maybe has had very bad grades in physics and astronomy and everything and mathematics, if he sees that India and China threaten to surpass the U.S. in something, even if he doesn't understand anything about it, he will feel threatened, and he will try to take action and support those who try to remedy the situation. So in that respect, these programs have a double meaning, and I'm following them strongly. The only disappointment always is that if another country has a space probe, it's hard to get the data, even on the internet. NASA has a long culture in distributing their findings and making everybody happy who is interested in what has come out from this special research.
Andy follows up his question from the UK and says, if NASA is our only hope, so to say, do you think it would be wise to internationalize NASA so that everybody contributes to funding and resources for space development?
I've written a cynical book that people need misconceptions to make life easier. And I think it goes in this direction. Could you say, I had a point. I could exactly answer the question.
Should NASA be internationalized so that
internationalized,
others pay,
right,
and help out in the support of it?
And in that book, I gave a lot of examples how international cooperation reduces or it gridlocks everything. We have examples in Europe. All those countries, look at Galileo, not Jupiter Galileo, but the GPS company.
The GPS program, you're right.
Yes. It's in a bad and difficult state now Because not everybody disagrees in what's going in what we have to do. The media tell it's going to be better than the American one. Everybody knows it's not, because it's delayed, and America doesn't stand still. It improves the GPS also. So GPS is a good example of what comes out if too many people work together. Look at the International Space Station. It was promised it will be $2.5 billion, I remember the numbers which were told, $2.5 billion cheaper by collaborating with the Russians. Then first it was delayed by 2 or 3 years, and the next number I heard was that it was $4.8 billion more expensive than if the U.S. had done it alone. So I don't think international cooperation among very different cultures is successful. And I dare to make the statement that Apollo, had it been done internationally, would never have brought us to the moon. It may be, it's not what the politicians tell who like to travel and make conferences and travel around and spend money. But historically and scientifically analyzed, that brings me to the conclusion that international cooperation is something which can be very tricky.
Tell us about your space and planet encyclopedias, and you have a DVD series about space, correct?
Yes. It was happening like that. I was writing a lot of books on different subjects about space in final 60s, 70s, and so on. And then I stopped doing it because space, not so much was going on. But then came the multimedia age, and I had all the possibilities of doing everything by myself. I was a programmer who has written about 500,000 lines of code in Modular 2 and Fortran and Delphi and so on. And suddenly I saw that I could become my own publisher. And I have published a planetary encyclopedia and a spaceflight encyclopedia, which didn't do more than combined all the texts, the pictures, and the animations I have created for television and so on. Improved by everything that I could do in the microcomputer age, hundreds of astrodynamical animations to explain complex concepts. And I had four CD editions of each between 1995 and 2001, and now four DVD editions, which are almost sold out already, between 2002 and 2006. Now, I notice, of course, as everybody knows, that the era of disk-based knowledge is over. Everything can be done now at a reasonable speed on the Internet. But on the Internet, you can't make money. So at the moment, I still serve some special audience of interested people by specialized DVD, which comes out in this fall, about these coming moon projects. But I am aware that many problems on internet-distributed encyclopedia will have been solved, because I'm not a teacher and have an enormous salary, in Switzerland at least, to support my hobby and distributing every publication free. I'm a freelancer, and so I'm one of those one of this group who has to ask himself, what's the future of distributing knowledge? How can it be done without being able to earn some flight income, which just supports your work and your family? You can't do it. So it was a great time to see everything I had done before. Television documents and all NASA releases. They have beautiful pictures and so on. And everything I had done in one homogeneous publication, that was a great thing in my life. I think it was Pythagoras, who 2,000 years ago said you can express everything by numbers. And that's what you do if you publish a DVD. A DVD contains as much punched cards, which would fill a couple of, about a dozen trucks. It's an enormous information, a lot of zeros and ones, and everything you have done in your life under control of your software can be published. That was a great 10-year era that I had, not as long as the 500 years of the book era, but the multimedia age was great, and I have made a lot of people very happy. They come to me after public speeches and say that they have spent evening and evening watching all those animations, and they know 100 times more about space now than what they knew before, and that's very rewarding for a publisher.
So they're not available now, or people can order them now?
One is still can still be ordered. That's Planetenlexikon, the planetary encyclopedia. It's all in German, unfortunately, and it's still on my homepage. It can be ordered www.stanek.ch. C-H is Switzerland, .ch. And they can look around. Everything is free. But if you order it in America with its higher edition numbers, it would be cheaper. It's about $70 or something. Around $70 for one of those DVDs. But if you compare it with what, let's say, Microsoft had for its Wine Atlas or Encarta and so on, it was still cheaper than that. And they have sold bigger numbers. So I can do it because I can do everything by myself, except the cover. And this is done by my son. He is an electrical engineer, and just a couple of weeks ago, he flew me in a Cessna 168 over the Bay Area. He is in a research center there and keeps his flying practice, so he contributed something for it, but all the rest of those encyclopedias, I did it all by myself.
That's right.
Why I can offer it at a reasonable price and still do it alone.
Is there any chance there would be an English language version?
If someone would do it, I have been thinking a lot about that. If someone would be doing that, he would have to translate about half a year. So it would always be half a year behind. And also, he would have to communicate with me every day by email. So we would have an edition which grows simultaneously. Simultaneously, almost in both languages, but 4.7 gigabyte is no longer enough. 8.5 is not in wide use. So there are a lot of tricky problems to solve that. And the main problem is that people think the era is over now of those discs, and the future is a paradise, everything free on the internet, and that's not going to happen.
I'm going to put up your URL for your Bay Area Cessna flight. When I archive this show, it'll be in the description, and people, again, the narrative is in German, but you'll understand everything about it, and the pictures are really dynamic. And how did you get permission to do all that filming at NASA Ames?
This was, if you look at it more closely, you will see that I was never in any restricted areas. So this is all public domain.
No, okay, so that's how you did it then.
Yeah.
It's a great video, and even though many of you can't speak German, you'll enjoy it just as much as I did. And check out his website. And for those of you who do speak German, you may be very interested in these Planet Encyclopedia and the DVD. And if anyone out there is a German translator with English, you might want to get a hold of Dr. Stanek and see if there's a way to put some of this work into English. Is there an email address where people can reach you?
Sure. That's my first name, Bruno at Stanek.ch. Stanek.ch. By the way, CH is Switzerland because it's in Latin, Confederatio Helvetica. That's the Helvetic Confederation in Latin. That's why we got this abbreviation, CH.
Okay. And do you notice that when you talk to other countries in Europe, or I'm assuming you've been able to make presentations at the ESA, at the European Space Union, what's your assessment of their progress, of their ability to move forward, of their interest in the kind of topics you're talking about today?
I had some friends working for ESA. Actually, I was working for them at the time when ESA didn't have its formal name yet. That means before 1975. And some of them are still there. Some were in satellite collision and so on. And I've talked to them a lot, and they were working hard. And some had were lucky with their programs. But when I see the overall progress and the input into those European programs compared to NASA, it's still relatively modest. But when I was working for the ESOC in Darmstadt on celestial mechanics, this was a very early time, you know, the very first highly eccentric orbit satellites which were launched at the time. And so I can't judge from that time. But the progress, well, let's take a more recent example, the Beagle. All the European press said it's going to be a great satellite on Mars landing. It will be much cheaper than what the U.S. has done. And in some respects, even better, but then it crash-landed, or it didn't have telemetry, and we don't even know why it died. So we usually start with flying colors, but we are just not ready to cope with American competition in that field. It was 30 times cheaper than a Beagle was 30 times cheaper than the two Mars rovers, but also England had probably 30 times less experience doing something like that. When I remember those two airbags landing, I saw the engineers jumping around in the control center in Pasadena. They knew they had the signal that the airbag was bumping around because it had periodic frequency changes. So they knew if it bumps around on the Mars surface, it hasn't blown up, and it's alive, and it's going to land. Now, this is something which shows the very high state of progress that the JPL engineers have. And if I compare that to, let's say, a recent comparable example, the Beagle, well, you judge by yourself. That's the difference. I have, of course, often to answer the question, why didn't you change it? Well, I'm always envying Claude Nicollier for having become an astronaut in Switzerland. We have almost the same age, just a couple of months difference, and a very similar education. But he was a military pilot, while I had a very bad accident as a youngster building rockets, and I didn't go to the military and didn't become a test pilot and so on. So this is one of the reasons I had to stay in celestial mechanics, which was more a mental profession. And so the influence was limited, and also I saw that I could do more pro-space by by trying to change the media, which I tried to do over the decades, wasting my time in organizations which were suffering from this international cooperation already at the time I was there. It means in the second half of the 1960s. So I couldn't change it. I see it that we in Europe are lagging behind. And why I still dare to raise the point, it's because the media always try to tell us how bad it is all in America, what they do. Everything is wrong what they do, and it's everything is great what we do. But we can't underpin it with facts.
I have a real change of pace question for you, and I'm going to go ahead and ask it. It is really off target and off topic, but this is from Glenn in Toledo, Ohio, and he says, David, I hope you'll ask this question. I know it is way off target for your topic today with Dr. Stanek, but I think also it may bear some bearing on what he is talking about in terms of always saying that Europe is better or more advanced than America, but that it's not substantiated normally by facts. My question to Dr. Stanek is, what is the global warming mentality in Switzerland and from your perspective throughout Europe? It's not usually trustworthy to believe our press that everyone in Europe is embracing climate change, Kyoto, and global warming, especially when, if one looks at Kyoto very carefully, it has the potential to wreak havoc on any economy that accepts it. Also, there are plenty of scientists that get at least a little bit of press that challenge global warming as a fact. I'm wondering what your guest today can say about global warming in Switzerland, maybe in Europe, and can you extrapolate any of that from science in general back to space movements between Europe and America? And because we're hearing the music and it's break time, Bruno will take your comments on that when we come back from our break. You'll have a couple of minutes to think up an answer to that question. And okay. Glenn, thank you for the question. It is off topic. We will address it. Everybody, back in 2 minutes with Dr. Stanek.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back to The Space Show, listeners. This is your host, Dr. David Livingston, and our guest today from Switzerland, Dr. Bruno Stanek. So, Bruno, we have this somewhat off-topic question. question, but he's asking you to do a little extrapolation about global warming and your perceptions of it in Europe and Switzerland and the United States, and how that might relate to some of the themes you've been talking about today with America, science, etc.
Well, I'm very thankful, grateful to this gentleman for asking the question, because I think the misconceptions are not yet totally beyond disrepair, despite Al Gore's efforts. It is a topic which is slightly seasonal, and I will explain it to you. This winter in Europe was extremely warm because one of those giant winds turning over the Atlantic was shoveling warm air from the Sahara to Europe. So we had a warm winter. While you in the U.S. had a terrible winter, very cold, lots of snow, and nobody thought it's the right time to talk about global warming too much. So this explains a different attitude to the topic on the two sides of the Atlantic. There are some very smart scientists and journalists who dare to point to the enormous contradictions in the theory of global warming. And they write, of course, because they are, in my opinion, on the right track, they write extremely good articles and homogeneous articles with no contradictions inside. They can afford to do it because they have the facts. And on the other hand, you have a bunch of people who really overstepped the boundary of logic and politeness. They call everybody a liar who disputes the right to show all those contradictions which are in that theory, that we had a much more enormous variations in temperature, in carbon dioxide ratios, in and they take out a very infinite decimal, as the mathematician would say, point in space and time, and extrapolate in a way which is just not permitted. That's impossible. So no hard fact for me points to really say that we are experience a global catastrophe soon. We have some glaciers which grow. At the time, more glaciers in Switzerland shrink. That's true. But also, at the time of the old Romans, you could walk over the Alps at many places where you have glaciers now. So we must have had a global warming before. There are other glaciers who grow in New Zealand. Why is that all ignored? Why is no satellite really give a precise medium temperature of the planet? If it's getting warmer, and that was often the case, you have more evaporation, you have more clouds. The albedo goes up because the planet is white instead of brown and green and blue, and it absorbs more. So this thermostat has saved our climate over millions of years. And we had volcano eruptions, which were as bad as Chinese pollution. And it couldn't change the climate. So for the good spirits of everybody listening now, I would like to say, don't be fooled by this panic. And I can afford to say that because I'm not one of those top scientists who has to keep his mouth shut, because he knows that his colleagues, and there are more mediocre colleagues of a very good one, would kill him. So open your eyes, start thinking, look at the contradictions, read well those existing articles who tell you, be careful about the panic, which it cannot only destroy, it cannot destroy the economy, it can destroy much more than that. So let's wait a while, work hard, and someone of the petrochemical industry, which we have in Switzerland too, because we have a good tax shelter, he said, if you observe that CO2 goes up and you want to have it go down, plant a few trees. Why is nobody saying that? Plant a few trees. That's doing so much more to reduce carbon dioxide. If on the other hand said, well, everything man does positive has no influence, only what he does negatively has an influence. No, that's not true. For every CO2 molecule you let out, you can have a self-growing tree, and it will reduce the amount within a couple of years again. Of course, you can't observe it because it's on a global scale, but just start thinking about the ratios, and then you will see we can do as much good as we can do bad. Following this crowd of panic people won't lead us anywhere.
In Switzerland, is the predominant thinking that global warming is an immediate and urgent danger caused by mankind?
If you go to the street and take the poll, you would see yes. But if you give them a lecture and give them the real facts and make the same poll of the same people walking out the conference hall, it probably would just be 20 to 80 and then 80 to 20. It depends on what you know, what you follow, and what you don't ignore.
Glenn asked for an extrapolation with space. So if we go back to the first segment of the show, and you were talking about scientifically challenged or scientifically uninformed media and press that would actually treat the moon hoax as being real because they don't know any better, as well as some not liking America. Can you make the same claim that the press promotes the fear of global warming because they're scientifically ignorant and they just jump on the mainstream trend? Is that the same kind of thing you were talking about in the first segment?
It's a total isomorphism. It's the same thing, yes. And it has the same reasons, the same origins, exactly.
And, of course, they don't.
You can see it every day. You can hear it. You can even, as a politician who talks about, today we had a politician in Switzerland who talked about problems with the Alpine roads and so on. And he couldn't leave it. He had to mention global warming as an argument for what he said. And you could see that he didn't think about what he said. He just thought it's a good argument in politics, so let's use it, no matter if it's true or not.
Probably helps get votes over there as it does here.
Probably. We are very similar still after 300-400 years of separation, yes.
As we're coming into the last 10 minutes or so of the program today and we focus back on space, what would your wish list look like for the next 10 or 15 years for space development?
My wish list is the following. There are forces against not only space in particular, but also against technology in general. And I hope that those forces putting up claims and showstopper concepts, that they disappear from their own contradictions. That logic somehow in some fields prevails. That's why I was also writing that book in German, Wie viel Irrtum braucht der Mensch? How much misconceptions do people need? Which was actually a remedy against this destructive view of letting be true what's good for you and not for everything. And so I hope that the planet heals itself. We had a very famous politician of the last 1,000 years, one of the Habsburg people. I once happened to meet one, Otto von Habsburg, and he said, if the politics Europe has had of the last 50 years, and you couldn't destroy it, you really can't destroy Europe. If politics of the last 50 years couldn't do it, nobody can do it. So I'm an optimist in that respect, and I think it comes back. Reason will come back. You can win exams with stupidity, and stupidity can't prevail in the press forever. So I think if the Americans are strict enough to follow the moon program, show the world we can do things you won't be able to do in 20, 30, or 50 years, people may start thinking again what's right and what's wrong. So I'm an optimist.
And you think it's important to return to the moon even though we've been there, and then to be able to build forth and go on to Mars. So you see value in this program.
It's an open horizon, and those people who take for granted that we shall stick on that planet forever, they have to admit that if we take a bigger perspective, if we say we can live for thousands of years on this limited planet Earth, if we take all the living space and the resources and so on, energy and resources from the solar system, we shall be a solar system civilization for hundreds or thousands of years, and leave the rest for colonizing the galaxy to our grandchildren. That's what space should tell us. We have an open horizon. We have great goals, not only the goals of football. We have other good goals, and this will last much longer. I have asked many people who won the coach race in Rome 44 before or after time. And nobody knows. But you know Pythagoras, you know Archimedes, and so on. The scientists of the era, the ones who discovered, these are the names to be remembered. In 1,000 years, you won't know who won this sports game or whatever. It's good to entertain people. Like in the old Rome, it was important too, but it won't last. So you will remember Armstrong and Aldrin in 1,000 years. That they were the first leaving and opening a frontier, which will lead to places like Las Vegas or Dubai on the moon or on Mars, for taking pictures on 16Gs and having fashion models walking around on the moon and under the reduced gravity look much better than they would look on Earth. So by the time this all starts, people will take it for granted, but someone has to start and someone has to do it.
June has sent in this question. I think we probably have time from it. She's in Houston. And she says, if you were to lecture before an American university student body or maybe some other American group, and you had just a couple of minutes to talk, why would you tell them or how would you explain to them that going to the moon is important and we should embrace it?
I'm one of a generation who has seen what positive influence it had on a generation when it was done the first time. And I'm sure this can be repeated. We need an open horizon. I would like to know what to tell my kids, what their lifespan might bring. We had it. We saw science fiction becoming reality overnight, and I wish it to every future generation. And when I see youngsters today who only read the negative news all over, and they don't have a playground to have a career, to be fascinated like we had, our generation had, and still stay on that limited planet, observe its minor changes, and get frightened, this won't lead anywhere. We need some people who can leave, have a bigger perspective, follow bigger careers than money or sports, and that's what the right mix inside the society to stay healthy over centuries. Otherwise, decline will follow as we had it before in the old Rome and everywhere.
Do you think it's important that when we return to the moon, we stay there and begin building a settlement and a permanent presence?
Absolutely, because if we if you know that a program is going on, let's say a 20, 10, 12, 15-year-old child, if it knows that the base on the moon is going to be abandoned by the time he's 25, he won't take that career. He has to know that this is a career which is always there. If he has a good idea and a dream to fulfill on another world, maybe he is devising a new technology to become self-sufficient, has a new idea of where ice might be hidden on the moon, and then you have a lot of hydrogen and can make for the lack of important three elements on the moon, which are carbon and nitrogen and hydrogen. Then you have at least two of them. On Mars, you have everything. I explained to many people, the moon is not so typical. Kraft-Ericke, one of your great pioneers who came from Germany, Kraft-Ericke always said the moon is just the industry because it's very short, but only because it's so close. Mars is the right place. Mars is a much interesting planet in some respects as the Earth, despite its lack of oceans, but it has all the essential elements on the surface while it melted down on Earth. And we only have the slack on the top where we live, and we are still happy about it, think it's nice. But we can change Mars into a very interesting body, not only into a giant Las Vegas, but into a planet where where some million people can live and make research and have a good life under 3/8 of a G. And they don't want to get back to Earth, and they prove that man can live on other places like the Earth. And to prove that this is possible within our solar system will be very important in the long run, into a future which we don't have to think about yet, but it's, someone has to do the start.
Do you have any concluding comments from the listeners or thoughts of wisdom for people to hold on to as we leave the show today?
No, but you know what I would like to do most now?
Yes.
Take the next plane, take my encyclopedia, and have a good evening with you, showing you everything and translating it for you, because you said you would have liked to see it in English.
Absolutely. When can you get the flight?
In 2008, I will be there, and I hope my son is still doing research in Palo Alto. And when I visit him next year, then I would come back to my offer to see you in some other place in California and talk about what we both like most probably over our lives, talk about the possibilities of progress in space.
Well, I'm all for it, and maybe as we go through your encyclopedia, we can do it as a live space show together, and do it that way. That might be really fun and somehow informative for the listeners. Even though they won't be able to see it, they can certainly get from it, the passion and the excitement and the descriptions that the two of us would be sharing with everybody. So I will look forward to that, and I hope the time passes quickly for that event to take place.
Thank you. Did I send you a copy already? No,
I have not received a
copy.
Not
yet.
No.
You will get one.
Okay. And I do want to thank you very much for being on the Space Show, and I look forward to another program with you on these subjects as things continue to move down the road toward space development, and I'm looking forward to seeing more about your encyclopedia when we get together, and this has been great. What city in Switzerland are you in?
This is Art. It's between Lucerne and Zurich, if you want, and a small lake, population 10,000 and so on, mountains of 6,000 foot around, so you can imagine, very nice landscape. And well, I also thank you for the opportunity. With my limited English, and asking for forgiveness by all Americans about my accent, the topic is the same for both of us.
It's been crystal clear, a better phone line than I have for many guests here in America, and it's been an excellent show, and I appreciate it very much, and am very happy for the opportunity to have had you as a guest. Space Show listeners, we have our next program, as usual, on Sunday. We have additional programming next week, so make sure you check both newsletters for the full scale of programming next week. And on behalf of our guest today, Dr. Bruno Stanek, and myself, we thank you for joining us and wish all of you a great weekend coming up. Goodbye from the Space Show.